conventional warfare, unconventional truce. Donald Trump first going all in with B-2 bomber raids against Iran's nuclear installations, and then surprising allies and adversaries alike with a late Monday ceasefire announcement. All this for a victory lap at the NATO summit opening in the Netherlands? Whether this is all strategy or impulse that's driving the U.S. president, we'll attempt to make sense of an operation that was rejected for decades by all of his predecessors, including, by the way, himself in his first term. Why did Israel finally get its wish of a U.S.-backed direct confrontation with Iran? Will it reshape a region where it's as much Israel as the United States that's imposed its will on Tehran's proxies and allies in Lebanon, in Syria, and Gaza? Who owns this one? And what does this seeming once-in-a-generation shift in the balance of power mean for the Middle East and for the wider world? Today in the France 24 debate, will this 12-day war reshape the region? With us from Washington, historian Arash Azizi, lecturer at Yale University. Your books include Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S. and Iran's Global Ambitions. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Rina Basist, Paris correspondent for Israeli Public Radio. Welcome back to the show. Welcome back as well to Azadeh Khan, professor of sociology at Paris Cité University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be joined by Nadim Houri, executive director of the Arab Reform Initiative think tank, shortly. Reminder, if you're on the go, you can always listen to the show wherever podcasts are streamed. This time, well, the guns have gone silent after dropping bombs. Donald Trump dropping an F-bomb to show displeasure with Israel and Iran for latent missile launches around his ceasefire deadline. Emerald Maxwell has more.
Visibly angry, Donald Trump accused both Israel and Iran of violating the ceasefire he'd brokered hours earlier.
We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the f*** they're doing. Do you understand that?
The U.S. president followed that up with a warning to Israel. Following a conversation with Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu's office said Israeli forces struck an Iranian radar site, but refrained from something bigger. Hours earlier, the Israeli defense minister had announced it was preparing to respond forcefully to an Iranian strike on its territory, which it said breached the ceasefire agreement, and which hit apartment buildings in the city of Be'er Sheva, killing several people.
Early morning hours, we were getting to go to work, and we heard the sirens. So me and my family ran to the bomb shelter. Everything was just like leveled. Everything was like destroyed completely. The whole apartment was upside down.
Iran, though, denied launching missiles at Israel after the ceasefire announcement. Earlier, Iran's foreign minister claimed its armed forces continued to strike Israel until the very last minute. Meanwhile, an Israeli strike killed another of Iran's nuclear scientists in the north of the country. Both Israel and Iran appeared to claim victory following the truce's announcement. At least 28 people have been killed in Israel since it first launched its campaign against Tehran on June 13th, while more than 970 people have been killed in Iran, according to the Washington-based group Human Rights Activists.
Yeah, and Azadeh Khan, we spoke with our correspondent in the Iranian capital earlier. He says it was furious, the barrages that came in overnight. Family, acquaintances, friends, are they breathing a sigh of relief now?
They start to breathe a sigh of relief, but not necessarily yet, because early this morning, Tehran was bombed harshly. And this was the harshest bombing of Tehran, various neighborhoods, and a lot of people have been killed. And nobody talk about them. We talk about Israelis being killed, civilians being killed by Iranian bombs, but nobody talks about Iranian civilians who have been killed, 1,000 of them so far, and 3,000 injured people. It is harsh, and people who have fled Tehran, for instance, still are waiting to see when and if they can really come back safe at home, because this is a ceasefire, this is not peace, and so people are waiting. Some do not have the means anymore to stay out of their houses and would like to come back indeed, but people are still waiting to see. better.
Rina Basis, people you've spoken to back in Israel, they believe this is the ceasefire, that there won't be another sleepless night on their side.
I think in Israel also people are waiting because there were at least three missiles that were fired after the ceasefire entered into effect. So people are still worried. Of course, there is a sigh of relief that apparently we did get an agreement. Let's just hope that it holds on. But then there is also the second stage, which is maybe even more important. I mean, this is a ceasefire, but the question of a deal that will see the end of the Iranian nuclear project and the end of the Iranian ballistic missile project, negotiations have not started yet. So that's hopefully for the future to come. And let's hope that, first of all, that the ceasefire holds, and second, that negotiation starts for such an agreement.
So let's get to that F-bomb that we heard at the outset, Arash Azizi. And really, how much of the last 12 days have been it's theater, and how much of this has all been carefully crafted? How do you have you made sense of what just happened?
I think, you know, it was a very important confrontation, of course, between Iran and Israel, something that we had waited for a long time and finally saw what it looks like in real life. I think it proved a lot of assumptions wrong. The assumptions, for example, that Iran will face some sort of a, you know, popular uprising that will bring the regime down, that didn't happen. And at the same time, it showed, you know, that Ayatollah Khamenei for years had shouted death to Israel and death to America. It showed in real life most of the dying was, as Azad has said, done by Iranian civilians. And, you know, it showed sort of the, frankly, a bit of foolishness of this policy that finally got Iran into this war. But I do believe the ceasefire is important, and I do believe it's likely to remain so, at least for a while. But of course, what really matters now is, you know, what will follow and whether Trump and the U.S. will be able to bring a new generation of nuclear talks, especially since the sort of technical details of nuclear program have also changed now after the U.S. attacks, and we don't know where the enriched uranium is, and, you know, this relationship with Iran and IAEA is at its worst ever. So there's a lot of hurdles, and Trump is not known to be a man interested in details. You know, the question is, how can we sort of get out of this?
And in the last hour, we've had at least one Iranian lawmaker saying that the country should keep out the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, the IAEA. Your thoughts on that?
You know, first of all, the Iranian, you know, lawmakers, this is the sort of hardliner dominated parliament that was elected in an election in which no one voted for. So, it doesn't really matter. But broadly, even people like Ali Larijani, who are like on the centrist side, he had this bizarre tweet, actually, a couple of days ago when he said something like, you know, we're going to, after the war is over, we're going to go after Grossi. And there's some people who are now accusing Grossi of his alarmist reports allegedly, you know, led to the U.S. attacks. I mean, I don't think that's fair, but that is what is being said. So, you know, what really matters is that can there be a diplomatic path for the Iran and the U.S. that will restore real limits on the Iranian nuclear program that can finally take care of it? Israel, kind of surprisingly, is declaring some sort of a victory and saying, oh, well, we took care of the nuclear program. They must know that's not really true. And at the same time, of course, there are many Iran who now advocate Iran leaving the non-proliferation treaty of 1968. And moving toward developing a nuclear weapon. By the way, this goes across the political spectrum. You know, whether you want a nuclear weapon or not doesn't map out onto the sort of regime factions. There are many who are actually anti-regime, were very critical of Khamenei, certainly, even think of toppling him. But their complaint about him is that he was too cautious and didn't let Iran develop a nuclear weapon. As an Iranian, I hope that's not the direction our country is going to go to. But I think there's a heavy sort of factional dispute in Tehran in between different factions of the regime. And what really will determine the course of that is not just like an abstract debate, but it's about what they can actually achieve. So if the pro-negotiation, you know, faction who wants to give up the nuclear program in favor of Iran's integration in the Western economy, if they're given support, if they are given a path that can bring fruits to the Iranian economy, they will win. Otherwise, there is definitely a danger of other hardliners, either Islamist ideological hardliners or basic sort of military folk who puts the emphasis on deterrence and, you know, all that, you know, they'll win.
All right, so there's, so there's different
internal fights in Iran are very important.
Yeah, different scenarios as to whether the regime lives to see another day or is replaced by something more moderate or something more hard line. Let's look at some of the reactions, right? There was, we talked about the casualties over the last 12 days. And according to Iranian human rights activists, it runs in the hundreds on the Iranian side, possibly higher, says Azadeh. The United States, for its part, claims, and it's pointing to the strikes at the on the nuclear facilities, that it's mission accomplished.
The president, without, knock on wood, having a single American casualty, obliterated the Iranian nuclear program. We are now in a place where we weren't a week ago. A week ago, Iran was very close to having a nuclear weapon. Now, Iran is incapable of building a nuclear weapon with the equipment they have because we destroyed it. So that's a very, very big thing.
All right, that's J.D. Vance, the vice president of the United States. Europeans, for their part, well, they want something Rina Basiste alluded to earlier, a return to diplomacy for France's president. There is the specter that Iran could quietly press on with nuclear enrichment coupled with ballistic missile manufacturing.
It's a real risk for the region, for Israel, and for all countries that would be within range of such a missile, which would include France. So this risk is there. It's a potential risk. And that is why we have considered from the outset that demanding discussions with Iran is the right way forward.
And as promised, Nadim Houri, executive director of the Adam Arab Reform Initiative, is here. Listening to those two views on whether or not these 12 days took out once and for all Iran's nuclear program, your reaction to those clips we just heard?
Look, it's, I mean, one thing I've learned from history is when people say mission accomplished in the Middle East, it rarely is accomplished. And the law of unintended consequences tend to happen. So I'm approaching all of this with a lot of caution. I'm not a nuclear expert. I have no idea what happened, what are the capacities of Iran. I'm not sure if anyone knows outside the Iranians. But one thing is clear, this sort of triumphalism, this strange war of 12 days, in my view, hasn't settled any of the underlying issues. And I fear that without a political arrangement, we're heading towards more uncertainty. Israel has shown military domination, that's for sure. They've been showing it for the last 2 years. But they've been unable to transform this military domination into any political project or any form of political hegemony. And I don't see them closer to that. And I think the U.S., with their massive involvement in Iraq and invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, have also never been able to, you know, to transform their military domination into any sort of sustainable political project. So I'm quite cynical. I'm very saddened by what happened in the last 12 days. And even listening to President Macron or even the Europeans, they were having negotiations just before. So is it more likely now that the Iranians would accept, or are they sufficiently, what is there left to negotiate? They either destroyed the nuclear program and there's nothing left to negotiate, or they haven't. And I suspect the Iranians would say, why would we negotiate? You just attacked us. We're going to either try to rush for the bomb or not tell you about it.
Rina Basiste?
Well, first of all, as said, that's true. We don't know yet if the program was completely demolished or not. But even if it was demolished, I mean, there is certain know-how that is still there. There are still at least 1,000 ballistic missiles that are still there, and the know-how how to produce more of them. So there are still things to be negotiated.
So you agree with the premise of Nadim that a military victory, yes, but it's Israel, with difficulty turning this into some kind of a political gain.
Not exactly. I think that from the start, this was the starting point of Israel, because when Israel launched this operation, it was going on the assumption that Tzal, the Israeli military, would operate on its own. Israel didn't know that the U.S. would indeed join the campaign. And if Israel is operating on its own, it's not going to be able to completely eliminate the nuclear program. It will do as much as it can. And if it does as much as it can, this means evidently that after a military operation, of course, the political or the diplomatic stage must come. There must be negotiations at some point. I think that even in Israel, everybody were well aware of that. And I think also now it's inevitable that negotiations would be needed because the Iranians didn't say for the moment, we are never going to try for the military nuclear ever again. They are not committing to that. So, of course, you need negotiations. You spoke about the Europeans. The Europeans were out of the game from the beginning. They never negotiated. It was always the Trump administration, and it will be the Trump administration. I don't see the Europeans joining any sorts of talks. So let's hope the ball is in Tehran's camp. They have to agree to come to the negotiations without any conditions.
So the United States, on the one hand, the B-2 bombers. On the other hand, you heard Donald Trump's clip there chastising both sides, saying, honor my ceasefire. It's all down to Washington?
Not necessarily, but for the moment, actually, because they backed Israeli bombings of Iran wholeheartedly, and because they are, it's the United States that is actually giving all these armaments to Israel. Of course, they have an important weight on Israeli politics. But what I wanted to say is that Iranians at this point, we don't know whether their nuclear facilities have really been destroyed. We don't know where the enriched uranium, 400 kilos of enriched uranium are. But at the same time, they will never accept to give up their missiles, never ever, ballistic missiles. And they, for the moment, they want to keep the right to enrich uranium up to 3.5%, which is authorized by the treaty they signed, non-proliferation treaty, which the Israelis did not sign or have not signed. Then what are they getting from Americans? On the other hand, don't forget that Iranians were negotiating with Americans, and it is Americans who left the table. It's not Iranians who left the table. And what they said was that...
So you don't see negotiations happening?
No, it is. A negotiation will happen. And now that we are in a ceasefire, not necessarily tomorrow, but they say that if Israelis really respect the ceasefire, we can go back to the table. But the issue at stake is, what are we going to negotiate about? If it's to give up or missiles, we're not. If it's we are going to give up the right to enrich uranium up to 3.5%, we are not. But then we can discuss, the other issues. And of course, if the sanctions are lifted, then they can come up with some agreements with the United States and eventually even with Israel.
Arash Azizi, was Donald Trump drawn in after the 12 days began, or was this the plan all along?
I think, we can't know whether it was planned all along or not, but I think it made sense from Trump's point of view. I think he thought that in the negotiations, he was being sort of played along. I'm saying that's what he thought, right? And I do think the Iranian side played a little, they didn't realize how impatient and mercurial, frankly, a little crazy, basically, President Trump is, like, he would approve something like that. So I think he now showed that, okay, we have no problem attacking Iran. We have no problem okaying Israeli attacks. But also he tried to play a bit of a both-sider, tried to criticize Israelis. I do see ground for negotiations. It's a good question. Why would Iran go back to negotiating with someone who left the deal in 2018, who... two surprise attacks in Iran. This question was asked even by American sort of mainstream commentators now. So naturally, it would be asked in Iran as well. But I think the answer is because the alternative to a negotiation is continued war, is prolonged war. And that's the real decision in Tehran. Does Tehran want to go into these conditions where, like a lot of other countries in the last few years, it would occasionally see Israeli fire, occasionally see American fire? Or does it want a durable deal that can really make Iran a country like Syria or Saudi Arabia that is not getting very favorable terms from the U.S.? I mean, this is posing the terms very starkly. But that is the conversation in Tehran. That is how people are thinking about it. So that's why they might take significant steps. And that might require changes in the composition of the Iranian regime. Whatever, whenever conversation we have to remember Khamenei is 86. He's hiding. We don't know where he is. But even if he reappears, you know, he's going to die at some point. So Iran is in the throes of a succession crisis. And that will determine what kind of policy it's going to adopt in this regard.
Nadi Mori?
Look, I think the... So what will happen in Iran tomorrow? Arash knows Iran way better than me, but clearly I don't see the doves or the peace camp somehow emerging. But we'll have to wait and see. But there's a big question. I mean, he mentioned Syria and Saudi Arabia. So Israel now is treating Syria as a free fire zone, just like Lebanon. So whenever they want, they fly and they assassinate, they attack, they do whatever. And I think they will be tempted to do the same in Iran. And I think this will create dynamics that will push the Iranians into more radical positions. Now, can Trump move from this sort of transactional diplomacy by tweets, stroking his ego, to a real political project that would preserve for Iran, just like the U.S. takes into account Saudi regional interests, whether they take into account the interests of key players in the region, including other Arab countries? There we can see, I think, the beginning of a new regional security architecture. But right now what I see is a ceasefire that can be broken in 1 week, in 1 month, in 3 months, and high levels of instability. A taboo has been broken. Iran has not been attacked in Tehran in that way, I think, since the 1980s, since the Iran-Iraq war. But the funny thing is, usually when these taboos break, then people say, okay, it wasn't the end of the world, you know? We can survive it. So, you know, I think you will see potentially higher risk-taking behavior. And it's the same on the Israeli side. So taboos are being broken every other day in the region. And I worry about that dynamic.
You agree with that? The last 12 days will embolden radical forces on both sides.
I don't know. But what I do see is that we have a country that since 79 has been threatening and calling for the destruction of Israel, that has not hidden, in fact, its military ambitions, its animosity to the free world. And we have seen also, and we had a demonstration now for 12 days, that they don't care about their own people. We have seen that with our own eyes. And because they are, entre guillemets, better negotiators, because they don't care about their own people, everybody's saying, oh, but Iran, they won't agree to give up the missiles. They won't agree to give up the nuclear material. So that's the starting point of negotiations. I think that the free world should ask itself, should we really accept that this would be the starting point of negotiations? It's a fundamental question.
And the I've Americans spoken... Did. And I, sorry, before Israel
yes,
bombed
before,
Iran,
before.
They did. They started.
Yes,
and
yes.
Iran
but
had,
that's not a justification.
Was enriching
that doesn't say
60,
that they,
uranium for 60%. Now they're saying we will give up that. All we want is 3.5%. I don't agree with that. I think that Iran should not have nuclear enrichment program, but this is what they say, and I think that this is the starting point of negotiations. Then, depending on what they're getting, they might also step down on uranium enrichment.
But the question,
if I may just finish,
go ahead.
Sure. What I wanted to say, please. I've spoken in the last few days with several European diplomats, so not Israeli diplomats. They are all telling me the same thing, that it is clear that Iran, before the Israeli attack, was advancing not only on the enrichment, because that we have the International Atomic Energy Agency that presented proof for that, not only on the ballistic missiles, but also on components towards fabricating the bomb. And it's true that apparently Khamenei has not yet removed the fatwa of producing the nuclear bomb, but everything is set in place. So when he gives the order, the process would be very quick. This is European diplomats telling me that, not Israelis. So I think we all must ask the question, what are the intentions of Iran? And if after these 12 days, they still insist... This is incredible. I mean, so of course we must arrive to an agreement that would ensure that none of this will happen.
But there have been ceasefire violations by Israel and South Lebanon. And because now that you have the air defenses knocked out on the Iranian side, Do you agree with Naim Houri? The temptation will be there for the Israelis to make the occasional raid.
We have Mr. Trump, who put his foot down, I think. So I think it's hard to imagine now that Israel will attack again Iran without the consent of the White House. And we have all seen the words of Mr. Trump just a few hours ago on that.
All right. Iran's revolution began in a way with the United States being a central protagonist in all of it. There was the hostage crisis at the time. Now, and you were mentioning Ayatollah Khamenei, Arash Azizi, he's 86. Can he take on all comers?
Well, I think he's finished in many ways. He's 86, number one, so he has so many years to live, but he's shown as a very inept wartime leader. He has, you know, a terrible track record. You know, you got to go back to like a few hundred years, not just a few decades, to find the ruler this bad for Iran. He brought economic destruction for Iran. He brought international isolation. He brought domestic repression. And his only thing was, at least we're secure, you know. We don't have wars. But then now in the last year, three nuclear power countries have attacked Iran. And you know, hundreds of Iranian civilians are now dead. Scenes of war is something that they'll remember. So Khamenei is in many ways is finished, and it's a question of what direction he wants to go. Now, your other guest was right that the Islamic Republic since 1979 has adopted this foolish policy of destruction of Israel, of declaring it, of funding militias who would fight Israel, of this anti-Americanism. It needs to be shelved for Iranian national interest. The question is, you know, when do we have enough patriotic elements, I believe even inside the Iranian regime, who will have what it takes to take the reins and take the country into a different direction. Although I should say that also Israeli behavior in the region, unlike you know, many other countries, I would say Israeli behavior is also quite arsonist, frankly, you know, attacking several countries, of course, committing massive war crimes in Gaza, for which now Israeli leaders have wanted that the International Criminal Court doesn't exactly shout free world to me. And, you know, so it really, for region to find peace and stability would also need, I hope Israelis can find a leader better than Netanyahu and a different path that sees peace with their neighbors and, of course, ends the shameful occupation of the Palestinian territories that have gone on for decades, that are unique in the world, and that are a destabilizing factor in the region.
So here's a question, Naim Houri, that we ask ourselves in the newsroom every day. It's a time of heightened tensions, but it also seems, and the last 12 days show it, a time of increased risks, of leaders willing to take risks, willing to take gambles, the gamble of the Israeli operation that Trump would go in on it, the gamble of using the B-2 bombers. Why are we living in an age of, and that's not just, by the way, the Middle East, but why are we have so many risk takers?
All right, so let's talk about the Middle East for a second. I think today a huge part of the problem is Netanyahu and the Israeli government. I mean, look, I have no love lost for the Iranian regime. I'm Lebanese. I've suffered from their exporting their ways of doing to Lebanon. At the same time, so, you know, Iran's behavior has to be constrained, has to be under international law. At the same time, what we have seen from Israel and particularly, frankly, the behavior of Netanyahu, wanted by the ICC and yet somehow not treated as a pariah as he should be by the international community, notably the West. The fact that even when there's a ceasefire signed and guaranteed by the Americans in places like Lebanon, Israel attacks and kills people every day. Today, they just killed actually someone who was affiliated with Hezbollah on the finance side and his two kids who were with him in the car. Just bombed like this out of nowhere. Syria, which the U.S. is actually supporting the transition in, gets bombed every other day as well. So there is a sense that power makes right, a breakdown of international laws. Europe is not even standing for international norms anymore. So yes, that accelerates this sense and these characters we have now in key positions of power, of thinking power makes right. And I think what is missing, and I think when we talk about the Middle East today, stability is not going to come neither from Iran nor from Israel at this stage. These two actors are highly unstable when you look at the map for all the countries that exist between them. The only hope, and I never actually thought I would be saying that, is for some sort of axis of moderation, so to speak, starting from Saudi Arabia, going through Jordan, all the way to Turkey, including Syria and Lebanon, that brings some sense and sanity, which finally stops the genocide in Gaza, leads to some negotiation to dealing with the Palestine question and giving the Palestinians their rights, and actually contain Iran and finds a natural place for Iran as a major country in this region, but also tells Iran, you are no longer allowed to sort of export your revolution and use all these countries as fodder for your own strategy or your own confrontation. There is a moment right now. I mean, in the irony of it all, there is a moment, because I think the military solutions have reached their limit. The problem is the actors who are sitting on top, they seem more interested in sort of wrestling match as opposed to laying down the basis for a 50 or 100-year peace in the region.
Recently, when Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia, Rina Basis, people are saying, oh, the Israelis are no longer flavor of the month, or certainly not top of the list.
What happened
to that thinking? Why? What was the calculus then? What's the calculus now?
The calculus of Mr. Trump, I think, is business first. So war is not good for business. So, you know, he finishes quickly. That's a good thing. And business that he can do with the Saudis or with Qatar are more important to him, apparently, than what he can do with Israel. It's as simple as that. So sometimes it brings good results, sometimes not. But I think whatever criticism might be on against the Netanyahu government, and I'm certainly not a supporter of it, I think you cannot reduce all of the problems in the Middle East to Mr. Netanyahu. I'm sorry, we had October 7, can't forget that. And we have Iran, who is almost with a nuclear bomb, which they could have thrown at Israel, and with an enormous missile program directed as Israel. I mean, the picture is a bit more complicated than that.
And Nadim's suggestion that there can be this sort of, can we call it a crescent coming up from the Gulf? I don't know.
That's what I hope for. I think this is the only adults in the room these days.
Well, I agree with Nadim 100%, by the way.
Okay, I hope so too.
I'm in favor of that axis as well.
But I think that we should give more weight to civil societies. Iranian civil society is ready to bring peace and forget about war if Europeans and Americans, for instance, would really take the civil society seriously. And I think that the alternative to the Islamic regime, which we despise, is coming from inside Iran and from its civil society. But nobody is actually taking this very civil society seriously. Because what we are seeing is that the Iranian regime does not really represent, as we said, its people. Mm. But the 80% of Iranians are against the regime. We have seen this before, several social movements. Iranians want to have normal, moderate relations with all the countries in you know, in the world, and also their neighboring countries, and so on. And so why shouldn't we think about civil societies everywhere, in Israel, in Iran, in Lebanon, and elsewhere? And why are we always focusing on these men in power, these toxic masculinities that are fighting against each other?
That was part of that initiative by Emmanuel Macron that was cut short by the Israeli operation there, to have this sort of civil society-driven conference in New York on the two-state solution.
Absolutely, for with Saudi Arabia.
Let me ask you, Arash Azizi, because we're talking about trying to get to empower moderate voices, but Mike is right. And you know, another lesson from the last 12 days, if America is in retreat on the global stage, well, then it's a very long process, because this crisis has served as a reminder that the U.S. still has more than 40,000 troops stationed in the wider region, everywhere from Djibouti to Turkey to, of course, the Arabian Peninsula. Again, the United States, at the end of the day, it always, if push comes to shove, will display might in this region.
The United States does have a sort of a massive sort of imperial presence, and it's a sort of guarantor of the security architecture of the region. But it is possible, I mean, I think, as Adim was also mentioned, we are getting some sort of a priority of economic development. A lot of diplomatic rifts in the region have been solved. A lot of countries are, you know, disavowing supporting militias in each other or ideological actors are more interested in economic development. Unfortunately, to Dr. Kian's point, you know, this is a sort of a, you know, there's a conservative, I call it the Congress of Vienna moment in the Middle East. So it's in a way not a great time for civil societies to have democratic aspirations of coming to power immediately in these countries.
Remind our viewers the 1815 Congress of Vienna, which redrew the order of Europe after the Napoleonic Wars. Tell us why you make that parallel.
Because it was a situation that came after the long French Revolution and then French Revolutionary Wars, and it ultimately preserved a lot of regimes. You know, most of the reactionary Russian regime, but it did sort of end the wars for a period. And I think that's the sort of what we're seeing in the Middle East. Hopefully, that we're going to a situation where wars can be ended. And I think those of us who are democratic activists, civil society activists, can hope to work under those conditions. To continue our programs at least when bombs are not falling. So that's sort of my perspective. And of course, I didn't say everything in the region can be reduced to Netanyahu at all. But I think Khamenei and Netanyahu are the two worst actors. And unfortunately, what we really need to see in Israel is just not just Netanyahu, but in Israeli political scene, Israel tends to win all the wars tactically, but it needs to learn how to win the peace. It needs to have some sort of a plan. It's strange that now in the Israeli political sphere, there is no real solution for Palestinians anymore. Sort of eternal occupation and apartheid in the West Bank. It's not even clear what the plans are for Gaza. And Syria, it's a good example. It's a new regime that has disavowed any attacks on Israel, and yet it faces quite a bit of destabilization from this government. So for the sake of people in Israel, Iran, and everywhere else, and our civil society, as Dr. Kian said also, I do hope that we can, we can move toward this peaceful frameworks that puts the wars aside, keeps the states inside their own borders, and that would really does. Fundamentally, that would only work if the Islamic Republic is fundamentally transformed, but also if a solution is found to Israel's conflicts with its neighbors, and most importantly, Palestinians. I think it is possible for something like that to happen, we should work towards it.
If there was a snap election tomorrow, Rina Basista, in Israel, and if you're Benjamin Netanyahu, after the last 12 days. Maybe some are even speculating, you were telling me that about such a prospect. Would there be a core, enough of a coalition to think about winning the peace?
Winning the peace, you mean a change?
Just as Arash Azizi described it just now.
It's a good question because there have been surveys in the past few months showing that, first of all, most Israelis would like to see the war in Gaza end and a ceasefire and bringing back all the hostages as a first priority, which is not apparently for the moment, because Mr. Netanyahu wants first to see the elimination of Hamas and the threat of Hamas against Israel. So there is a majority on that front. But then, of course, many Israelis supported the attack on Iran, fearing...
They supported the attack on Iran, but my question is, is there a core of politicians who think about these issues, like the two-state solution, like normalization with neighboring states?
Yeah, of course. Of course, many people in the opposition think about that, and you should have seen the number of Israelis that arrived to Paris for the conference that didn't work out so well at the end of the day, that took place on the same June 13, Friday. But speaking about civil society, of course, we would all love to see all the civil societies of the Middle East speaking and interacting and maybe building the future for our children. But we have seen what happened in Iran just a few years ago with the demonstrations. Does anybody really think that the regime of the Ayatollahs would let the civil society in Iran open a dialogue with Israel? I'm not so sure.
Nadim Houri, you've been on the show before to talk about the sort of the moment of overreach, perhaps, after the fall of Bashar al-Assad, of the Iranian regime, its proxies, which found themselves exposed. In your country, Hezbollah was inspired by the Iranian Revolution when it was founded back in 1982. It's on the back foot today. Have the circumstances of the last 2 years improved Lebanon's lot?
No, so there's hubris in our region, right? There was an Iranian hubris moment, and we're seeing the end of it, and we're living in the middle of an Israeli hubris moment right now. And I think the faster we get to the end of it, the better it is for everyone. Is the lot better? I don't know, because there is a real need today to reform. There's a desire to reform. There is a real desire across the region to get on with something else, to rebuild lives, societies. But at the same time, I cannot talk about civil society, and I come from civil society, when today 80 people in Gaza were killed. Mm. Today, 56 while waiting for humanitarian distribution, supposedly by a U.S.-supported foundation. I mean, we're living in a sort of a dystopian
world. So which side is the United States on?
No, the United States is clearly on the Israeli side. And for me, what's interesting with Trump, and I think we saw that very clearly, what is the real U.S. national self-interest? It's very hard. Trump tweets 2 days ago that he's for regime change. And right now he tweets that he's against regime change. I have no idea what Donald Trump stands for at the end of the day. And actually, if the U.S. is the hegemon supposedly guaranteeing the security architecture of the region, it's not doing a particularly good job when you look at the number of countries and capitals that have been destroyed, bombed, and the number of millions displaced. So yes, for civil society. But to me right now, the priority is stop the genocide in Gaza. Go back to a negotiation process. There is a real appetite in the region for a real political settlement, but one that does not just give Israel a sort of green light to do whatever it wants and to dominate the skies, and everyone else just has to subdue themselves. If that's the approach, we will see. I don't know which form it will take, but we will see new forms of armed resistance groups, new supporters emerge in the region in the coming years.
All right, we'll have to unfortunately leave it there. Azadeh Kian, I want to thank you. I want to thank Nadim Houri. I want to thank as well Rina Bassist, Arash Azizi for being with us from Washington, D.C. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.